as a woman, as a Muslim, as a Moroccan citizen, full citizen, I am entitled, I feel entitled to read, rethink, and talk about a religion because it rules my life. It rules my whole life. Marriage, divorce, children, everything. So if I'm not entitled, then who's then?
Lots of well-intentioned but ineffective initiatives here in Morocco by international development agencies tend to come in and say, let's do awareness raising for law enforcement officers and judges. Well, that assumes or presumes that these people are actually insensitive or just need awareness, you know, and which is not the case.
Hello there. Welcome to episode number 4 of our podcast, Minding the Gap, Conversations on Gender. I'm Sara, I'm a research assistant in ECDPM, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today we're going to talk about access to justice in Morocco. Access to justice is a human right. Fair and equal justice prevents conflict, frustration, and resentment in society. Barriers to justice, on the other hand, reinforce poverty, exclusion, and fuel social disorder. This is why an inclusive, fair, and equal access to justice is considered a cornerstone of democracy and rule of law, and effective and sustainable development. Narrowly speaking, access to justice means having the right to appear and be heard in court. The broader definition of access to justice, however, takes into account the social context in which justice is executed, and sees access to justice as a set of legal and institutional conditions which make legal services effective and available to everybody. While access to justice should be ensured to everyone, in reality, men and women have different experiences and face different obstacles. Today, we are going to explore together why it is difficult for women to access justice, and we are going to do so by taking as an example the case of Morocco. Why Morocco? Well, because it presents a justice situation that can be taken as an example for the women's experience in the North African region and will allow us to shed light on some lessons. In order to do this, I'm together with two experts that will guide us through the nexus between gender and justice in Morocco. Houda Zegri is a consultant and specialized researcher in international cooperation, family law, gender equality, and migration. Houda has more than 10 years of experience in the management of cooperation projects concerning civil society and NGO support, gender equality, and women's rights. Hi, Houda, and thank you for being here.
Hi, Sara. Thank you so much for this initiative and for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here.
Stephanie Wilmar Bordeaux is a founding partner of Mobilizing for Rights Associates based in Rabat. Stephanie has worked for over 23 years in collaboration with diverse NGOs and legal practitioners across the Maghreb to promote women's human and legal rights. Both at Mobilizing for Rights Associates and as a consultant, she designs and implements a range of multifaceted women's rights legal empowerment programs, which are implemented at the grassroots level. Hi, Stephanie. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Thank you for the invitation, and it's a real pleasure and privilege to be here with both you and with my good friend Houda. So thank you for inviting us.
So I would like to have an overview of the situation in Morocco today. So I'm looking at Stephanie. Stephanie, would you tell us what's the current situation of the justice system in Morocco? What are the main steps achieved in the justice system? And where are the women, actually?
Thank you. Well, I think that the first thing to recognize is that access to justice for women is multidimensional, as set out by the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, right? Access to justice encompasses just disability, meaning that women have legal rights that they can go to court for. It means that the justice systems are available, are accessible, are good quality, that victims can get remedies, and that justice systems are accountable. So to answer your question on a very formal level, Morocco has made some significant steps forward in the justice system that benefit women in the past, say, 20 years. In 2004, there was a new family code enacted related to women's rights in the family. In 2018, more recently, there was a law on the elimination of violence against women that was passed. We should also acknowledge the 2011 Constitution, which guarantees equal rights of women and men in all areas of life, as well as guaranteeing access to justice for everyone, men and women, for the defense of their rights. So that's the legal framework. Structurally, we should also note that there's a 2013 charter for the reform of justice system that put into place some important structural, practical institutional measures to guarantee women's rights in the justice system, such as increasing collaboration with local women's rights NGOs, setting up a special unit in law enforcement and justice systems for women victims of violence, and establishing social workers in all of these different units in hospitals, police stations, and the justice system. Again, these are all formal advances, so we'll get to the reality perhaps later on in the conversation.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Stephanie, for this overview. It's really clear. But then let's start to scratch a bit the surface, as you said, and let's try to go underneath. Theoretically, justice reflects the social situation and framework of a population. So I was wondering, to what extent does religion and cultural beliefs influence the justice system in Morocco? Can we say that Morocco has a society based on patriarchy? And therefore, to what extent do laws and interpretation of laws perpetrate and sustain, and how does interpretation affect women?
Well, first of all, let's recall for everybody that Islam is the state religion. So that's official, and the whole family law is built upon an Islamic frame of reference. So that's the reality. Now, the issue is, what Islam are we talking about? Because when we know that we follow, you know, in Islam we have four schools, and we follow the Maliki school, but we take some references from other schools. But when we talk about this, it seems like it's like there is a book somewhere where the old Islam is written there, and we take our laws from there, which is not the reality. The reality is that the Islamic law is a huge corpus. It's very vast. It's been built on centuries, and it's not a fixed thing. It's not static. It has been evolving, and it has to continue evolving. So it's very dangerous when we say just in general, well, this is Islam or this is Islamic rulings, or because we're not sure about what we are talking about. So now, for example, the family code, Stephanie mentioned before, the 2004 family law, it is modern code, but in the last article, the reference is very clear. If something is not included in this code, we go back to the Maliki school, which is really very large. And sometimes, or very often, unfortunately, we find judges applying at the same time the positive law, the family code, and using references from any author, any scholar of any century, he likes him. So he would put that to justify his decision. And this is, in my opinion, and the opinion of many people, this is dangerous, because as citizen and in front of the justice, we need fixed rules for everybody, and we need to know what we are talking about. Now, we know that the Islamic law, it's not only divine rules from the Quran. It's also the human interpretation that has been made to these rules. We have also a problem that the scholars. Our scholars are not independent people. In general, they are working for the institutions. They have a salary, so they are not very neutral. And sometimes we can We see that. We see that they are disconnected from the reality, from what's going on the real life. So they are in the books, in tradition, in, you know, they are like the chevalier trying to protect our traditions, but that is not, it's not always works for the reality and for the lives of citizens. Now, I'll give you just a small example of the impact of the religion. Like, let's take, for example, the concept of Kiwama. You will see it everywhere now because it's there's lots written on that. And it's hidden behind all the patriarchal rules. And it is a human interpretation. It is not in the Quran. It was interpreted by the fuqaha, the scholars. And it means the superiority of men over women. And even the word, the concept Kiwama doesn't exist in the Quran. The whole Islamic system is built upon that superiority of men over women. And whenever we try to change something, we are stuck by that construction. And this is why there is a big movement now of women rereading the Quran, trying to rebuild and deconstruct and rethink religion. Now, you tell me, are you entitled to talk about Islam or to talk about religion? For centuries, we were not. And we're still not, but I am, as a woman, as a Muslim, as a Moroccan citizen, full citizen, I am entitled, I feel entitled to read, rethink, and talk about a religion, because it rules my life. It rules my whole life. Marriage, divorce, children, everything. So if I'm not entitled, then who's then? Of course, we have all the respect for all the studies these scholars do all over the years. But now I think women are just taking the decision of deciding. We decide for ourselves that we are empowered enough to think about the religion and to try to reform the family code, the family laws, seeking for justice, which is the finality of all the religions.
Thank you, Huda, for this really clear explanation. We already started talking a bit about the barriers that women are facing in the justice sector, as Huda was just saying, and the possibility for them to question what has been in place up until now. I would like to talk a little bit more about what the challenges are for women indeed to access justice, and why indeed they are more disadvantaged than men.
There are basically three interrelated phenomena. The first one is discriminatory and unclear laws, right? The second one is the absence of a regulatory framework for public actors charged with applying the laws. And then the third one are different, the third barrier is different structural, material, and human resources challenges. So I'll try and briefly kind of go into examples of each one of these. In terms of discriminatory and unclear laws that have, you know, very important gaps, I'll limit my remarks to the penal code, because the recent 2018 law on violence against women basically is not a separate law. It amended the penal code provisions related to violence against women. And related to what Huda was just talking about the importance of religious interpretations of laws, I'll let Huda expand further on obstacles to access to justice related to the family law, because the family law is based on religious precepts. It's the only law in Morocco that does so. But if we talk about the penal code that I will, religion does not have any formal role in it. In fact, the criminal code was based on the French criminal code. So again, you know, religion does not play a role in that. But so some of the current shortcomings and discriminations in the criminal code have to do with discriminatory provisions against women, such as the criminalization of sexual relations outside of marriage, which impacts women differently, the lack of any effective response to rape. You know, marital rape isn't, you know, criminalized, and there aren't any effective protection measures or specific remedies for women victims of violence. So as a result, women are unlikely to report crimes of violence committed against them. Because of the criminalization of sexual relations outside of marriage, if women suffer violence from an intimate partner or an ex-intimate partner, or if they're raped but can't prove that it was, quote, against their will, they risk being transformed from victims into criminals themselves and being prosecuted for sexual relations outside of violence. So that's one big obstacle, in addition to complicated, expensive, and unclear.
If I can add to this, actually, apart from actually being criminalized, they also face, I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, the shame also from the family and difficulties socially, I would say, because they are indeed depicted as the ones that were raped. So they become, from, as you said, from the victims, they become criminal. So apart from the law, they are also facing all sorts of other obstacles in reporting the crime per se.
Well, I think we want to be clear that the law is actually perpetuating and fueling this kind of social stigma. And so we, rather than talking about, you know, fears, we prefer to, fears of being stigmatized or fears of being prosecuted, we prefer to talk about threats, because it is the state that is making the threat of women that they will be arrested and prosecuted, and it is then family members or society making threats against the women to their personal security or to their children's personal security if they do something. So just kind of a vocabulary clarity here. So this is a reason why women don't report crimes. Overall, men are much more likely to report legal problems than women, I think 50 to 40%. So those are just a few examples of the discriminatory provisions within the penal code. The second barrier to women accessing justice that I mentioned is the absence of a regulatory framework. And people's eyes usually tend to glaze over when you talk about regulations, but these are super important. Lots of well-intentioned but ineffective initiatives here in Morocco by international development agencies tend to come in and say, let's do awareness raising for law enforcement officers and judges. Well, that assumes or presumes that these people are actually insensitive or just need awareness, you know, and which is not the case. Justice sector and law enforcement officials don't have the clear procedures, the standardized protocols, the guidelines, etc., that they need to be able to have clarity on their roles and to have responsibilities and the power to do their jobs. And they're not held accountable for their performance. So when you don't have those types of regulatory frameworks, local public actors cannot do their jobs properly. And as a result, you get people interpret laws, you know, differently. There are different practices, and cases related to women across the country are treated quite differently or decided quite differently depending on the individual justice system actor managing the case. Okay, so there's disparate application of the law across the country that impacts women. And then finally, the third barrier, you know, are all of the nuts and bolts, structural, material, and human resources challenges to women obtaining relief from the justice system. And those are everything from linguistic barriers among Amazigh women who can't access the Arabic language justice system, illiterate women, who, you know, over 50%, about 50% of women in Morocco are still illiterate. That's a big barrier to being able to read, you know, documents, write out a complaint, fill out forms, etc. Women with disabilities have challenges accessing a justice system that doesn't have a disability perspective or have accessible buildings. There are costs related to transportation, costs related to paperwork, costs related to bribes and payments for access to justice. And then finally, as we've seen in the challenges and frustrations related to the current relief efforts with the earthquake, women in rural areas are just geographically isolated from public services, including the justice system.
I would like just to point out at the awareness point that the issue that you mentioned, Stephanie, because it's very important. I would like just to give an example. when we talk about, yes, let's raise awareness, et cetera, et cetera. Regarding minor marriages in Morocco, which is a huge problem, we tend, because it's so easy to find a guilty person, we tend to say, well, we have conservative judges, men and women, and so they perpetuate the situation. But when you dig in and you ask them, and you, they really, do they have really, I mean, independently if they are, they agree or not with the, with the idea of marrying a young girl less than 18 years old, the law has made this possibility. It opened this bridge, and all the people, they just take advantage of that. And what they say is that the reality is harder than that. When you have a 16-year-old girl coming with her father and saying that she is consenting to this marriage, she wants to get married, and they don't even see the husband. I mean, it's just the girl with the father, or the, and she is willing to get married, and they refuse. What happens in the practice is that she comes a year later pregnant. So, because if we still, and again, religion plays a role here. In Islamic religion, you know that the contract marriages is something modern, it is new. We didn't use that before. So still until now, if two families gather and have a small, like we call it the publicity. I mean, you make the event public, and you read the first surah of the Quran, and you agree, these people are married in the eyes of God. They officially, administratively, they're not married because they don't have the contract. But it is, I mean, nobody would say anything. It is accepted morally, religiously, and we know that it exists. So these people, what they do is that they go back, if they, the judge refuses to give an authorization of marriage, they go back home, they do their life in a normal way, and they come back, they do it on purpose. And when she comes back, she's still 16, 17 years old, and she's already pregnant, in front of the judge, you have two minors. And you know, in Morocco, if you're not legally married, the child will pay the price, because he will be a child out of wedlock and has no rights. He is, or she is, linked legally to the mother and has no legal link to his father. So no inheritance, no name, no nothing. So, I mean, you put yourself in the place of the judge. What can he do? Okay, what can she do? So, yes, of course, I mean, there are people who are very conservative, and they, deep in their hearts, they agree with the minor marriage and think it's not, it's okay. But still, we need, the legislator needs to cut and shut, because we know our cultural situation, we know our society, we need to cut breaches like this and gaps like this, and help the judges to do their job and to end this practice.
If I understood correctly, this also has to deal with the interests of the child. As you said before, there are some judges that are conservative and they actually approve the marriage because of their beliefs. But there are also other judges that see this possible marriage as in the interest of the, usually it's a young woman. But this is actually really interesting, and it connects to something else that I wanted to talk with you about, which are, indeed, so far we kind of dig a bit on the barriers of women to access justice. But I was wondering, what are, indeed, the other, if there are other barriers and obstacles in the justice system when we talk about, for example, divorce or guardianship?
Well, it's sure, it's all interconnected. I mean, that's a fact. The 20 years of implementation of the family code has shown many deficiencies, and this is normal in a law. You need to practice it and to see it on the field to see the deficiencies. And we don't have the time in this podcast to address all the problems and the issues. But I would point out at the post-divorce situation or issues, and
Because it looks like when you see and you study the family code, it looks like everything is fine. And there is this equality between men and women from the day they are born until they get married and suddenly they have children. And then you have, you it seems like the woman loses the whole equality and the whole control over herself, over her children, over her household, everything. So this is very important. And again, it is built on the concept of Qiwama, which underlines that the superiority of men and the privilege of men. And it is hidden everywhere. So let's see, like, for example, the nafaqa, because we tend to say in Morocco, we translate it in English to alimony, and alimony doesn't exist in the Moroccan law. Because there's nothing for the woman. What we have is child support. So child support is a very problematic issue, which is very, very common. I mean, it's like almost normal to be living after divorce with problems of a husband that not willing to pay the child support, trying to avoid it, being late. You know, it is the common situation. So that puts the woman in a situation more vulnerable than before, especially when we have lots of cases of men marrying young girls and asking them or not letting them study or work. So we're talking about women who are not empowered economically, don't have enough studies, sometimes illiterate, facing the reality with 2, 3 and more children and in a sudden way. And this is a really, really big problem in Morocco. Then we have another point. This is the division of community property. And in Islamic law, when you marry, you don't have common community property. So it's divided. In Islam, at the beginning, it was made to protect women's property. So the idea, I mean, the source, it was good. I mean, it was thought for women. But now in reality, it doesn't serve the woman because most of women in Morocco have nothing. So they intermarriage, they have nothing. And after 10, 20 years of marriage, and we talk about poor class social classes and also the middle class social class. So you intermarriage and then the assets are all in the name of the husband. The big stuff, the house, the car. And the woman, even if women are working and are paying for all the needs of the family, they're doing the small thing, the invisible payment. So when the divorce is there, the woman has nothing. So she's without a house, without anything. So that's also a very big problem. There was some practice in the Berber area, which is like jurisprudence. And this was the Ked Westiaya. In those places, women have lands. They inherit lands. And when they intermarriage, they have lands, they have sheep, they have animals. And we know that they work in the field with their husbands. When the divorce happens, there is a division of those assets. And that was, you know, a jurisprudence made by judges of the areas. So at some point in Morocco, activists, women activists, ask for the same thing to be done for women, for all Moroccan women. But they refused. They said, no, that's a cultural thing. That's an ethnical thing. We're not doing it. They refused. So until now, we didn't solve this this problem. And we come to the legal guardianship. Because of Qiwama and superiority of men, supposedly, because in the Quran we have nothing like that, and Quran, like all the religions, men and women are equal before God. So when you build the system on this, the legal guardianship is for the husband, for the father. But it's not like only in family code, which is surprising, and sometimes we, even Moroccans, we get surprised by it. You find it hidden everywhere. If you are a Moroccan mother and you open up a saving account for your children, and at some point you need to take out that money, you cannot. I mean, you put it from your own money to your children. You cannot. The bank asks you to bring the father. He is the only one because he is the guardian of his children. He is the only one. Yes. Yes, Sarah, go on.
No, I just wanted to ask you, what about actually if the father is not there? Does it change anything? Do you have maybe an example on this?
It's blocked.
It's the same. It doesn't change.
It's blocked. Yeah, it's blocked. I mean, you can go to justice and have the proof that the father is absent and that you can have, you will need the judge's authorization.
Okay, approval, yeah.
And I mean, this is, I mean, the banking system is really far from Islamic rulings.
Yes.
But it is applied. I mean, it's funny because, hello.
It's everywhere, and, as you said.
Yeah. And all the small details of a divorced woman are linked to this. Changing the children from schools, yeah. Deciding for surgeries, many, many, many things that the administration would ask you to bring. Passports, traveling abroad, they would ask you to bring the father. So imagine, I mean, in the most of the cases, the relationship is not good. There is revenge. There is tension. The children are, the interest of the children is not taken into account at all. And just last point, I know I talked a lot, sorry, the hadana, which is the physical custody. It is presented as a privilege for women. Oh, we love you so much that we let you cook for children, sleep or not sleep with the babies. You know, all this physical custody and all the work and the care going with the physical custody. This is not a privilege. I mean, of course, I do believe that children had to be with their mothers. I'm not saying I'm not against this, but it has to be seen as a huge responsibility. And if you don't give resources to this woman, you're just breaking down a few human beings, the mother and the children.
Thank you, Hoda. This has been really interesting, especially to hear about the examples, because in my mind, usually justice is perceived as something really far from our everyday lives. But indeed, what we've been talking so far about is the reality. So we see these so perceived so far away laws that are there and don't touch us. And instead, it reflects on our own lives. So thank you for bringing forward these examples. But at this point, what I would be curious to talk about is, why are we still talking about this? Like, why are these obstacles still there? What can be done to overcome these barriers and obstacles that we've been talking about? And I would like to hear from both of you, starting maybe from Stephanie.
Well, I think the answer to the question about why are these obstacles still there is in some sense fairly easy. These obstacles are still there because someone or some people have a vested interest in these obstacles still being there and benefit from all of these obstacles still being there. It's interesting. We did a study recently on technology facilitated violence against women, and we examined the perpetrator motives for committing such violence. And it basically boiled down to two things, sex and money. And, you know, we truly believe, and experience has shown us, that exploitatory behaviors and practices come first, and then the discriminatory ideologies tend to follow in order to justify the behavior and the practices. So all of the things that we talked about earlier with women's access to justice in the criminal code, for example, or the examples that Huda gave with the problems in the family code, have to do with sex and money, because they basically sustain the power, privilege, and impunity of men, right? I mean, the family code provisions that Huda described perpetuate what I would call unjust enrichment of men who have unjustified, unearned wealth because they're not coughing up their fair share of child support to women or sharing inheritance, you know, equally with women. They're benefiting disproportionately from these provisions. Same thing with the criminal code provisions related to violence against women. You know, men can rape with impunity. They can commit violence and not be held accountable. It maintains the unequal power relationships within marriage and even outside of marriage. You know, why are sexual relations outside of marriage and illegal and illegitimate children, as Huda described, not considered deserving of a financial support from their fathers. Well, because that way, then men don't have to financially support children born outside of marriage. So it's all about, maintaining those sexual and financial privileges and advantages accrued onto men. That's basically what it boils down to.
I totally agree with Stephanie. It's all about sex and money. And we take, again, the minor marriage cases. When you study this, I mean, you get amazed about the reality, what's going on. In all these decades of minors marrying, we only see the visible image is that the girl and the father or the mother coming to the court. The man, the husband, as if this girl is marrying an invisible person. I know in Europe and the US, there is this, what we call the Romeo and Juliet clause. And this is for, teenagers, let's see, like, for example, 18 years old boy with a 15 year old. Anyway, the age is very close. So maybe they are in love and they have the girl is pregnant and they get married. Okay. So this is made for these cases, which is very logical. We don't have this in Morocco. We don't have these cases in Morocco. In Morocco, we don't give a girl, a minor girl, to a boy of 19 years old because he has nothing to offer. What the kind of marriages we have in Morocco is 50, 60-year-old men, maybe married twice or three times or whatever, many of them living in Europe, coming to Morocco to find a girl. I mean, a minor. We're talking about children. And he is not even visible in the whole problematic thing. We don't mention his name. He's not supposed to be in the court the day of asking for the authorization. Now we're starting to ask to have his name and age. And this has to be called with its real name. This is human trafficking. And this is taking advantage of the poverty. And there you need punishment for those both men, or with the father and the husband. And the girl should be treated as a child. And I don't understand why we never talk about consent of children in anything. And then suddenly for marriage, the girl is big enough to give her consent. Mm-hmm. We need to protect children. And, in the field, you see really that it's not shocking for some people that, like Stephanie said, somebody is interested in the status quo. And the feeling we have in Morocco and many Arab countries is that the evolution is so slow. And sometimes you go to two steps and then come back with one step. It's like, we will give you some rights, but not too much. Don't be happy. Not too much, because otherwise, I mean, I know it is a bad solution to be in a country who gives more rights to men or more rights to women. What we need is, first of all, children protection. And we know what's going on in the world now. We need to really be aware of the interest of the child, to empower the judge to see case by case, where is the interest of this child? And then try to balance between the rights of men and women. What happened in the family code is that it was named the family code because somehow we needed to make sure and to men, Moroccan men, who was like, oh my God, more rights for women. We have nothing for us. They are leading the world, whatever. So we used this term that, okay, this is the family code for the family, not for men, not for women. But what we see in reality is that whenever we seek the balance of a family, we do it at the expenses of the woman.
I can see that you speak with your heart on this topic. So thank you also for doing that. And we touched a little bit upon in the way to overcome this, as you were saying, Huda. So now I turn to Stephanie again to see if she has some more points to add on how we can actually overcome these obstacles.
Yeah, there are actually two current opportunities that, if seized, could lead to increased access to justice for women in Morocco. The first one is in July 2022, the King of Morocco called for new reforms to the family code, which makes sense. I mean, after 20 years. And the Minister of Justice has been holding consultations with civil society to solicit input into the reforms. So this is a critical opening for analysis, for advocacy, to fill the gaps for women's access to justice in family matters. Again, an opportunity if seized, if women's groups are active in advocacy, if we can achieve an evidence-based advocacy rather than advocacy, based on ideology or fake science or whatever. And then the second opportunity, despite its shortcomings, the 2018 law on violence against women actually did provide for the establishment of multi-sectoral units, as well as committees at the local, regional, and national levels related to violence against women. So these are basically committees that unite all the different stakeholders from the health sector, from the law enforcement sector, from the justice sector, again, at these three territorial levels to develop solutions and develop outcomes and strategies for addressing violence against women in their communities. So it's there's two strong points. It's local and community-based, and then it's intersectoral with all of the different actors. In some places in the United States, this is referred to as a coordinated community response, because local NGOs working on women's rights and who have centers for women victims of violence can participate in these committees quite closely. So this is another opportunity that, if used properly and seized, could help provide real relief and real innovative grassroots level creative solutions related to violence against women and women's access to justice in violence cases at the local level.
Well, I would just remember this, that we need a revision, deep revision, and this is what I think people are working in their corners trying to think of revision, because we cannot continue doing small amendments here and there. It needs to be really thought of as a whole system, as a whole revision, and there is a need of harmonization of between the laws, because otherwise it's emptying the laws from there. If you have a very progressive family code and then you have a criminal code that cuts everything, there's no, no sense to this. So it really has to be a global revision of all the laws. I would also say that we in Morocco, we have a lack of specialization of the judges. And maybe it's linked also to the lack of human resources. And I think in gender-based violence, a specialized judge is very important. He or she makes the difference. I worked with an institution, with an international institution, and we tried to focus on the Spanish example. They have a very interesting global law on gender-based violence. They have gone far. We should maybe be inspired by their example. But for now, I am told that it's very difficult to have a specialized courts. But at least we need, there is a tendency to there. And it is very important because when you have a victim or a profile of a woman victim, if things get so lost between courts, between judges, between attorneys, between social assistants. But if you have a specialized person with knowing that case and the file from the beginning, you can save lives and you can help make a difference and help a lot. So in my opinion, specializing judges, at least in this very sensitive issues, that would be an important point. And we really need in Morocco to take notice and to be aware of historical moments, as we talked the other day, Stephanie and me, and she was talking about the U.S. where the amendments are easy to do for the laws, which is not the case in Morocco. So whenever we have a law, we spend many, many, many years before we amend it. So before putting out in the field a law, we really need to be aware that this is a historical moment, and we need to really think of the impact of that law, like the law against violence against women. It took so many years, and then it was not sufficient, and it was not what we expected from it. And it shouldn't be even called a law, because it's just criminal code amendments of some articles. So that's a missed historical moment. And if we wait, like for the family code, we waited 20 years. Before that, we waited 50-something years. I mean, it takes long. And meanwhile, there are lives, people who suffer.
What kind of lessons can we learn then from Morocco?
I don't know. Some time ago, I decided to do my best to be positive. I believe in the change. This world is changing. I believe that we have to go forward and not be shaken by those who don't want change. It won't be easy. There's something I think it's very important is the generation passing the information to the next generation. In Morocco, the activists, feminist, we were really lucky because we had some strong women. They come from families who were against colonization, so they were brought up in families and homes, patriotical and, you know, with high political sense. So they were really prepared to do the work. This is being lost, and I know all over the world. So we need really to show the next generation that women's rights are not a gift, and we cannot take them for granted. Anywhere, anytime, a crazy guy can take the control and say, "You go back home and don't talk anymore." So we cannot take them for granted. We have to continue, and of course, we need to have new, fresh ideas. Youth have to be involved in this, and we have also to work on masculinities, because we are really stuck if we only work with women on women's issues without involving men. This cannot continue like this. I mean, we need to change mentalities and to work together in this. It will take time, but we need to do it.
Well, Huda is absolutely right that we really need the importance of systemic, thorough, and meaningful reforms, and not just window dressing, right? As a PR strategy, I would add two things, two lessons learned from Morocco. The first one that experience has shown us is that awareness raising is just not enough as a change strategy. And again, like I mentioned, there's lots of, you know, well-intentioned but not well thought out in terms of theories of change initiatives that come in and say, well, let's just do awareness raising of, you know, women about their rights, in quotes, in the family code, or let's do, you know, training for judges, you know, to tell them, you know, you should be nice to women victims of violence, kind of stuff. I mean, I'm you know, characterizing a little bit, but honestly. And those types of awareness raising issues are just not enough if, as we saw with the obstacles and the barriers to women's access to justice, women need concrete assistance to navigate the justice system in face of all of those different practical barriers. And law enforcement actors and justice system personnel, they need clear and concrete regulations and guidelines to be able to do their job, you know, not just another training session telling them to be, you know, nice to women. Perhaps the second lesson that we'd share is that change has got to be local. I'll give one example. In Morocco now, one very important change that happened in the past decade or so was that certificates from the hospital for women victims of violence to obtain to be able to then file a police complaint are now free at public hospitals. And that was not always the case. Women used to have to pay the equivalent of $20, which is a lot in the context, to get those certificates. And that is now, it's now a ministerial circular that those have to be free, but that was not a top-down reform. That was advocacy by local NGOs in one province advocating to their local provincial hospital to give those out for free. And once that happened, that NGO with whom we collaborate, they shared that good practice in a kind of horizontal scaling across, right? Instead of scaling up, scale across. And it got adopted across the country and emerged as a good practice. And so the Minister of Health basically just had to adopt something that was already practiced and accepted. That is how change happens at the local level. Because as we've seen in Morocco, you know, top-down change from the national level down, it takes too long, as Huda said. It's ineffective because it's not responsive to local realities, and it's ultimately not sustainable. So the key takeaway would be that the change has got to be encouraged and facilitated at the grassroots level up.
I agree. This is something usually that is not really talked about. We usually go straight to the national government or institutions because we see it as a easier way to implement reforms and change, while instead there are examples from the ground on how you can actually implement change. So thank you for this example. And I think I learned a lot of new things. So I want to thank both of you for your time here today. And thank you indeed for engaging in this discussion with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Stephanie. It was a pleasure.
Thank you both so much. It's always a pleasure to be talking with both of you.
Great. Thank you again. That's all for today. And for our last episode, Hannah and her guest will guide you through examples of gender-sensitive climate action in cities, and you will learn how women empowerment, climate action, and urban development are interlinked. Until next time, and thank you for listening.